parent star. Then telescopes in orbit measured the tiny dip in light output from Sirius A when the planet transited across its star's shining face. From these data, the eager astronomers of Earth deduced the planet's size and surface temperature. Now the task was to get visual images of the planet, to photograph its surface, and measure the constituents of its atmosphere, if it had an atmosphere. No telescope on Earth could produce such imagery at a distance of nearly 84 trillion kilometers. Not even the telescopes in space could reveal much more than a blurry speck of a disk. But calculations showed that a set of very large telescopes working together as an optical interferometer might be able to resolve surface features on Sirius C. The telescopes would have to be in space, clear of the Earth's murky, turbulent atmosphere. Owing to the driving ambition of Anita Halleck, the International Astronautical Authority decided to build such an interferometer in solar orbit. Its segmented mirrors would be placed at opposite locations along the Earth's orbit, producing an instrument with a baseline of 2 astronomical units, nearly 200 million kilometers. The lunar nation of Cellini was already constructing a radio telescope facility on the far side of the moon, where it would be insulated from all the radio chatter of Earth by more than 3,000 kilometers of rock. Far side, the side of the moon that is permanently pointed away from Earth, was the quietest place in the solar system for sensitive radio searches for intelligent life. The radio telescope, dubbed Cyclops, was to consist of 1,000 dish-shaped antennas, each one 100 meters across, covering a total area 10 kilometers wide. When the IAA announced its plans for the space-based optical interferometer, one of Cellini University's distinguished astronomers, Professor Jason Ulrich, proposed building a more modest optical instrument on the moon's far side. After all, the surface of the airless moon was effectively in space. The vacuum at the lunar surface was actually 1,000 times thinner than the vacuum in Earth orbit. Lunar materials could be used to build the telescopes, and the moon offered a firm platform for them. So the Farside Observatory became the site for an optical interferometer consisting of 3 interlinked telescopes, each with a main mirror of 100 meters, slightly larger than an American football field, more than twice the size of any telescope mirror built on Earth. They were to be erected in 3 giant craters. The longest distance between them would be about 1,800 kilometers. And in the midst of the optical instruments, the Cyclops radio telescope was being erected. Professor Ulrich was named to head Farside Observatory. He enthusiastically proclaimed that the observatory would be the finest and most important astronomical facility in the solar system. Yet even in the gentle gravity of the moon, building such large and complex structures was a challenge to the skill and knowledge of the men and women who came to Farside. More than anything else, it was a test of their perseverance and their heart, a challenge that brought out the best in some of them. In some of them, it brought out the worst. Farside Observatory. "Farside Observatory coming up," announced the cheerful voice of the Lobber's pilot. "We'll be down in Mare Moscovienzi in 5 minutes." Trudy thought that down could mean a crash as well as a landing, but she tried to keep the worry off her face as she tightened the straps of her safety harness. "The Sea of Moscow," McClintock said knowingly. "It's actually just a big crater. Korolev is bigger. So is Mendeleev. Not like the Mare Nubium or Mare Imbrium on the near side." "When a crater's that big," Trudy replied, "it's called a ringed plain, not a crater." "There," she thought. "Let him know I'm not a total ignoramus." Unperturbed, McClintock went on. "Lots of features on the far side are named after Russians, you know. One of their early spacecraft was the first to observe the far side." Trudy nodded as she stared at the display screen above her head. She saw a curving range of worn-looking rounded mountains, then a flat plain pockmarked with small craters. It looked dusty, bare, utterly barren. And then, "Look, the Cyclops array." Hundreds of round radio dish antennas stood lined up across the floor of the huge crater. The scene reminded Trudy of the segmented eye of an insect, and it looked as if the ship was hurtling down straight at it. She glanced across the aisle at McClintock. His handsome features were set in a tight grimace, as if he were trying to steer the ship himself by grim determination. His hands were gripping the seat's armrests tightly. "I'm not the only one who's nervous," she realized. "Retro burn in 30 seconds," the pilot announced, sounding much more serious than before. The ground was rushing up to hit them. The array of radio telescopes slid out of the screen's view. There was nothing out there now but empty, barren ground, strewn with boulders and pitted with craterlets. It looked very hard. A roar and the pressure against her back, like something slamming a 2x4 along her spine. Then it stopped as abruptly as it had started. "We're down," said the pilot, cheerful again. "Welcome to the Far Side Observatory." Trudy heard several sighs of relief and realized that the loudest one was her own. Then everybody started to talk at once, unbuckled their seat harnesses, get to their feet. "We're here," she thought. "Now the work begins." She stood up and reached for the overhead luggage bin. McClintock leaned across and opened the hatch for her, then pulled out her meager travel bag and handed it to her. He was tall as well as handsome. Trudy's plain, lank hair barely rose to the level of his chin. "Thank you," Trudy said to him. "You're quite welcome," he replied. Then he grabbed his own bag and started up the aisle toward the passenger compartment's airlock hatch without another glance at her. Trudy shuffled along after him, walking carefully in the light lunar gravity. She was ordinary in every way, she knew. Average height for a Canadian woman, with a slim build and dull brown hair. No beauty, although she thought her light green eyes were kind of nice. Men rarely noticed her, especially tall, handsome guys like McClintock. "He's got no interest in me," Trudy thought glumly. "He made conversation with me during the flight, that's all." The trouble with living on the moon, Trudy quickly decided, was that you never saw the moon. You were indoors all the time. Trudy stepped from the Lobber rocket's passenger compartment into an access tube that was sealed to its hatch, then along the spongy-floored, rib-walled tube into a reception area where a young man in a slightly ridiculous-looking pumpkin-orange jumpsuit took her travel bag from her and handed it to a gleaming white robot that already had a half-dozen other pieces of luggage draped on its many arms. Then the young man led her through a maze of corridors lined with closed doors. "Your luggage is being sent to your assigned living quarters," he assured Trudy. "But Professor Ulrich wanted to see you the instant you arrived." The kid was kind of cute, she thought. Curly blonde hair, light eyes. Kind of chubby, but his round face was smiling pleasantly at her. Probably a freshman, drafted from the university to work for the Far Side Observatory. Students made a handy pool of slave labor, Trudy remembered from her own undergraduate days. She glanced at the name tag pinned to his chest. Winston. The observatory's living and working areas were underground, of course, like all the human communities on the moon, built into the side of the ringwall mountains that surrounded Mare Moscoviense. The lunar surface was airless and subject to temperature swings from nearly 300 degrees in sunlight to more than 200 below zero in shadow. Hard radiation from the sun and stars drenched the ground, together with a constant infall of dust mote-sized micrometeorites. It was safer underground, much safer. But dismally drab, dreary. The corridors were tunnels, really, narrow, their low ceilings lined with pipes and electrical conduits. Trudy wondered if they would turn her into a claustrophobic. "Be careful how you walk," her young guide warned. "In 1/6 gravity, it's easy to go staggering around like a drunk rabbit." Trudy had paid strict attention to the orientation lectures back in the space station before she'd headed out to the moon. She very deliberately scuffed the weighted boots she had bought during her brief stopover at Selene along the corridor's plastic-tiled floor in a bent-kneed shuffle. It reminded her of videos she'd seen of chimpanzees trying to walk on their hind legs. Her guide stopped at a door marked J. Ulrich, Director, Angel Observatory. Angel Observatory? She asked. That's the observatory.